website, and you can turn the light off here. And this says Snake River flowed backwards. And this is actually an exposure down here in Lewiston that these really coarse, darker materials, those are large rocks that are from the Lake Bonneville floods. And then the lighter colored stuff, you might recognize that this is some of the slack water sediments like we saw at Wawai'i Park. And so this is what they said. Snake River flowed backwards, Ice Age floodwater surged across channel scablands, across the Palouse into the Snake River with such a discharge, the river was back flooded 80 miles east to beyond present Lewiston, Idaho. On the banks of the Snake River, south of Lewiston, gravel bar laid down by a single Ice Age Bonneville flood is overlaid with flood sands from several Ice Age Missoula floods. So, you know, you get the idea. They kind of keep it short and to the point. But really, you guys did a good job of coming up with some nice alternatives, a lot of good graphics. Many of you included a regional map, which, you know, is great because if you're trying to show floods and those types of things, and you are here, that type of an approach really works well.
Are you going to submit one?
Maybe. You look at that county park, and unfortunately, I don't think they've got the, if you wanted to pay for it, I'm sure they would gladly make a sign of most any of the ones that you guys turned in, honestly. But then they need to have the trail down there, too, and they're probably not prepared to do that yet. But one of these days, there'll be something there. Okay, a couple things about this week. Number one is Thursday afternoon in lab. We've got the third exam. And if you haven't looked yet, there's a copy of the one from last year up on the website that you can take a look at. And what we're going to be doing is covering the material, starting with diagnostic horizons and features. Okay, and we went through all of those, and then we got into the formative elements and various aspects of the family. We talked a little bit about the structure of the system, you know, how you put these formative elements together to come up with the taxonomic names and some of the information that's contained in there. And then from that, we started on the soil orders, and we talked about gelosols, histosols, and last class period, we talked about spodosols. Today will be andosols, so that'll be the material that you'll be responsible for, just up through today. So any questions about that?
How much will be on the soil taxonomy? Like, is it going to be?
Well, it's sort of what we're talking about.
No. I mean, as in like the name. Like, if you were to put out like a soil type, a soil series name.
Okay, I think at this point, unless it's something that we specifically covered with one of the soil orders we've gone over, that you probably just want to focus on how the system works, like what's the suborder level, and you know, I gave you some examples of I think there was a whole list of taxonomic names, which one is wetter or which one is moister, you know, and the ones that's where you have to look at the suborder, great group, subgroup, and kind of use that as a way of deciding. So it'd be more of that. I don't expect you to memorize all those formative elements, but you probably should know some of the ones that we've talked about specifically. Okay? Anything else? And what we can do on Thursday morning is take a little bit of time, if you guys have questions from studying, go over them. I think we did that last time. You had about 30 minutes worth of questions. So, and that's fine if you want to. I'm glad to take the time to go through it. So if we go back to our 12 soil order keys here, our simplified version. So we work our way down. We're down to number 4 here, and it says andosols, soils formed in volcanic ash. And that really is kind of a gross oversimplification of what andosols are. Yeah, if a soil has formed in volcanic ash, it's likely going to be an andosol, but as we're going to see that there's actually a much more specific definition. And in fact, if you look at the actual key in soil taxonomy. You can see this definition is not too complicated. And it says here, other soils that have andic soil properties in 60% or more of the thickness, either within 60 centimeters of the mineral soil surface and between either the mineral soil surface and the top of an organic layer of the andic properties, which is shallower, whichever is shallower than a densic, lithic, paralithic contact. In other words, a shallow soil there, or shallower soil. And I guess what I would pull out of this, two things. One, this concept of andic soil properties, and I'll say a little bit more about what those are. And then there is a thickness requirement embedded in here. If most soils, you have to have andic soil properties in 60% or more of the thickness within 60 centimeters of the mineral soil surface. So 60% of 60 centimeters is going to be how many centimeters? Yeah, so essentially around here where we have these what we call ash caps or ash mantles, it has to be at least 36 centimeters thick in order to qualify as being an andisol. So there, like we've seen before, there are these thickness requirements. So it's possible you might have an ash mantle, say up on Moscow Mountain, that's only 20 centimeters thick. Well, in that case, it's not going to be an andisol. All right, so just something to keep in mind. And I don't want to belabor the definition. This is andic soil properties right here. And you can see there's a lot to it. And if you read through this thing, it talks about the, really in general. And kind of the main concepts here are that these materials, these volcanic materials, whether it's volcanic ash, pumice, cinders, any of this stuff that gets blown out of a volcano, it tends to weather fairly quickly, and it forms these poorly crystalline types of weathering products. And we talked about allophane, and you can see that's mentioned in here. They call them short-range order materials. And allophane, amygdalite, you mentioned ferry hydrite, metal humus complexes. These would be some of the weathering products that you would typically find in soils that have andic soil properties. I don't think there's any reason to go through this too much more, but this is a list of the required characteristics of andic soil properties. And you see item number one, less than 25% organic carbon. The number two, you could have these things, bulk density of 0.9 grams per cubic centimeter or less. And if you've ever seen volcanic ash, you know it's kind of light and fluffy, so it has this relatively low bulk density. Phosphate retention of 85% or more, and I'll say a little bit more about this, but what it means is that if you add phosphorus to a soil with andic properties and you shake it up and then you measure how much phosphorus is in solution or still available to plants, it's not going to be very much. And we call this phosphorus fixation or phosphorus retention. And it's actually, from a plant standpoint, probably not a very good thing. And it's just that these types of minerals, the ferry hydrite and allophane that you have in andic soils, are very good at grabbing on to phosphorus and holding it quite tightly and making it unavailable to plants. And then this is aluminum and iron that's extracted. You have to have at least 2% of that. And this ammonium oxalate extractant is simply something that dissolves these short range order minerals or poorly crystalline minerals. And so we look at how much aluminum and iron is there. And this is kind of similar down here. That's item number three, except it talks about having a minimum of 5% volcanic glass in the soils. And in fact, I think most of the ones we have around here is how this would be what qualifies them as having andic soil properties. And I'll show you some examples of these. But it's things like what I would think of as the mineralogy. You've got things like allophane, ferry hydrite, the short range order minerals, high phosphorus retention, low bulk density. And those are, in this case, the presence of volcanic glass. Those would be the kinds of things I would think about. Now here's the final thing, and this is Andic soil properties, and it's you can see here the shaded area. It's a function of iron and aluminum that you extract, and then how much volcanic glass is in the soil. So if it falls in the shaded area, it qualifies as Andic soil properties. You see, it gets kind of complicated. So let's go back to the simple one. Soils formed in volcanic ash, and if we look at the information here on the Andesalt homepage, this is kind of interesting. The word ando, which is the root for andesol, comes from Japanese, and it means black soil. And what happened is after World War II, the USDA sent a bunch of soil scientists to Japan, I guess as kind of a strategic thing to see what sort of soil resources they had. And they started seeing all these really black soils that had very unusual properties, and these are ones that were formed in volcanic materials. They hadn't really been looked at much in the United States, and so they wanted to incorporate it into the system. They had to come up with a name, so they got this idea of black soils, because a lot of the ones that were in Japan that they were looking at have these melanic epipedons, the really dark surfaces, and we'll see an example here in a second. It says these are soils that have formed in volcanic ash or other volcanic ejecta, and that's most of the time. There are actually soils in the world, and some in the Pacific Northwest, that have andic properties that have not formed from volcanic ash or volcanic ejecta, but they're more rare. I would think of it as, you know, the soils that typically form in the material that gets blown out of volcanoes. It says they differ from soils of other orders in that they're typically dominated by glass and short-range order colloidal weathering products such as allophane, amygdalite, ferrihydrite. They have these andic properties, which are really unique physical chemical properties that include things like high water holding capacity, which is good for plants, and the ability to fix or make unavailable to plants large quantities of phosphorus, which is not a good thing for plants. So it's kind of a good news, bad news thing. Globally, andesols are the least extensive soil order. They're only about 1% of the land area. And you look on this global distribution map, this green color, you know that you don't see any huge areas of it. But if we start close to home, you can see the Pacific Northwest, volcanically active region. And in fact, if you want to look at the main distribution of andesols, all you have to do is trace what's known as the Ring of Fire. And you can start down here, tip of South America, up through the Andes, Central America, the Cascade Range, on up into Alaska, come on over, get down into Japan, and down into Southeast Asia, Indonesia, and New Zealand. So what you're looking at are these tectonic zones where you have plate collisions, and it's normally an oceanic plate that's underwriting or being subducted under continental plate. And what this does is it creates a lot of pressure and tension, and sometimes that tension and pressure gets released in the form of a volcanic eruption. So that's why you find andesols in these places. There's also places like Iceland, which has a lot of volcanoes. Hawaii doesn't show up very well here, but it's a volcanic chain. The Rift Valley in Africa, you'd also find some andesols there, but not much of the land area. You know, that said, they are disproportionately used, and in fact, many places that they're sought out for special use for crop growth and so on, because they usually offer several advantages over the other soils that are present there. In the U.S., if we look at the distribution, it's about 1.7%. You can see they're really all, on this map anyway, they all show up in the Pacific Northwest for the most part, northern Idaho, northwestern Montana, and across Washington, Cascade Range, down into Oregon and California. See this one little dot down here in New Mexico? Anybody know what that is?
Caldera.
Yeah, the Valles Caldera, this huge volcanic caldera that's found in northern New Mexico. And interestingly enough, there are some soils in the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina that qualify as andesols. And they're not formed in volcanic material, but they're fairly high elevation, and they have the type of mineralogy that you get in an andic soil. And believe me, the people that like the Natural Resources Conservation Service in that part of the country, they are really pissed off that these soils classify as andesols. And at least to this point, they've refused to recognize it officially, just because they don't. Everyone has this idea that an andesol is associated with volcanoes and so on, which they usually are. But this has really made some people unhappy. Well, if you look at the classification of these things, there are 8 suborders, and here's the listing of them. And you're going to start to see, as we go through these soil orders, you'll see some common trends. Notice the first ones that come out, Aquin, so these are the wet andesols, and you probably recognize most of these now. Gel ands, those would be the andesols that come from places with a gelic temperature regime. Cryans, these would be the andesols of cryic temperature regimes, so the 0 to 8 degrees C mean annual soil temperature plus the cold summers. Torans, these would be andesols from aridic areas, so the toric moisture regime. Xerans, xeric moisture regime like we have around here. A lot of the andesols in the northwest would qualify there. Vitrans, these would be the relatively young andesols that have quite a bit of glass in them. You might notice the root there, vitri, means glass. And ustans, ustic soil moisture regime, and finally udans, which would be a udic soil moisture regime. So you can see how important climate is in how these things break out. Yeah, Hannah?
Which ones are the most important ones to memorize? This is most suborders that we've had.
Well, I don't really think there's much to memorize. You know what these roots mean, right? UD means udic, UST means ustic, ZER, xeric, right? So I guess I'd look at it a little bit differently than memorizing, but hopefully you could see a name, cryand, and you know what that is.
Yeah.
This map here is a little bit dated, but it shows that, number one, this purple color, the vitrans, and this lighter purple color, cryans, you can see how those are a lot of the dominant ones in northern Idaho and western Montana. So they're fairly high elevation and not terribly weathered in terms of the extent. So kind of young. Yeah, Mateo?
There's no in this order the art ends, so the default category.
Say that again, sorry.
The default suborder is like
hard, and we don't have those here. It's all climatic, with the exception of the one suborder, which were the vitrans, the glassy ones. And the rest of it is moisture or temperature regimes. The xerans, the yellow color, you can see those are more dominant in Northern California and up in parts of Washington. The udans, the green color, more of the coastal areas in Washington and Oregon. And we've got them in Idaho too. They're just not going to show up on a map of this scale. What doesn't show up here at all are torans. And those are not very extensive. Some people argue that it's probably a bad choice for a suborder, because in an aridic moisture regime, you generally don't get much weathering. And a lot of these volcanic materials just don't develop andic soil properties. Well, that, as I said, that's a little bit on the dated side. So if you look at the suborders, there's a ton of them here, and you actually can array them, one of these ternary diagrams. So you got wet, dry, and cold, and you can see how these kind of come out here as you go from the aridic moisture regime or toric moisture regime up to the aquic moisture regime, and then these vitrans kind of thrown in the middle there represent the glassy ones. And I might even say that this is still a work in progress. This is, if you took this class 5 years ago, you'd see a different array of suborders. So as we learn more about these soils, the system is changing to accommodate the newer knowledge. If we take a look at some of the examples here, this first one is from New Zealand, and this is a typical landscape there. You can see the very pastoral with grazing and some forestry in the background. But this is an area on the North Island of New Zealand known as the Taupo Volcanic Zone. And they say this is the most active or the most frequently active rhyolitic volcanic area on Earth. And about 1,800 years ago, it was 233 AD, this Taupo volcano erupted, and it was just a huge eruption. It ranks as one of the, you know, largest that we know of in the history of the world. And one of the things about it, and it's kind of interesting, it produced this pyroclastic flow, which, anybody ever heard that term before? Yeah, what's a pyroclastic flow? Yeah, gases and ash and a whole mixture of stuff, and it's heavy. So it comes out of the volcano. Instead of something like the picture you might have seen of Mount St. Helens where it gets blown up really high in the air, this kind of comes out and then it just spreads over the landscape and seeking the lowest point because it's heavy. And this is interesting. They estimate that it spread over about 20,000 square kilometers in a period of 7 minutes. So as cool of a thing as that would have been to witness, it probably was not a very safe place to witness it from. And what it did is it wiped out all the forests that they had, just completely incinerated them. They did come back. The soil here that would be in the foreground looks like this guy. And you can see this is a fairly typical thing you run into in these volcanic landscapes is you've got some different eruptions, and this is manifested in the form of these buried horizons. So here's the younger eruption of Taupo, about 233, and then this one is the older eruption about 27,000 years ago, which was huge. And so you've got VW horizons, not a whole lot of development, and here you actually have a buried A horizon on top of another BW. So the lithologic discontinuity in this case is simply representing different eruptive events. The couple notes on here. Notice the classification, ashy / pumiceous, mesic, typic Udivitran. You notice how there's nothing about texture in there? It just says ashy and pumiceous. With andesols, the traditional concept of texture and percent sand, silt, and clay is not quite as meaningful because of the nature of these short-range order minerals. And so instead of using the traditional loamy, fine loamy, coarse loamy, sandy, those types of things, we talk about the ashy, medial, hydrous families. And it's just what they call a particle size substitute. And most of the soils we have around here and this one are described as being ashy because they tend to be not very that highly weathered, and it feels ashy when you pick it up and texture it. So I guess the point here is you don't see things like fine loamy and coarse loamy and so on because the material is so different. The pumiceous would refer to the presence of pumice, which this thing has quite a bit of, and I think it's I think you've all seen pumice. We had some in the lab. It's real light, and most of it would float on water. The typic Udivitran, Vitran suborder, so it's got a lot of glass in it, eutic moisture regime, and then the typical variety of it. Another example of a andesol landscape. This is in Costa Rica and Central America, and you can see there, well, these are houses down here, but as you get up, this is actually the slopes of a volcano there, And as you get up on these slopes, you find that there are more and more of these areas that have been cleared and used for agriculture, because at least in a situation like this, these andesols are probably the most productive soils that they have, and they're pretty highly sought after for coffee production and well, other specialty crops as well.
Is it because are they high in acidity, or?
Well, there are a few reasons. One of them is water holding capacity. Another one is that it's younger material, so it tends to have a little bit higher nutrient status than some of the more highly weathered soils in that type of environment. They're easy to till. It doesn't take much to plant stuff in an andesol because of the low bulk density, so you don't need the input of labor or energy to till it up. There are a lot of reasons, but you know, there are some problems. But and the note here, these soils have extremely high organic matter contents and very high water holding capacity. And here is the soil profile. And this one is classified as a melanudan. So that's the grape group classification. Recognize the root M-E-L-A-N, melan. What does that refer to?
Melanization.
Yeah, and specifically, what sort of a diagnostic horizon? I remember mentioned a melanic epipedon, the surface horizon. I said it's kind of like a mollic epipedon, but it's formed in volcanic materials. And that's what this looks like. And it's just black. And the organic matter content in here, if you read down, is 16.4% in the upper part here. And it really doesn't drop off too much. Even if you zoom, let me show you a larger version of this, a little bit better. You can see these, I don't know how, a little bit of glare, but the dark colors extend all the way down to about 70 or 80 centimeters in this profile. So that's a really thick A horizon. Not unlike what you guys saw up in the Arboretum last week with that one pit. But anyway, a lot of organic matter, and then finally you get down to the bottom, here's a BW horizon. One of the interesting things about this soil, water content at wilting point ranges from 147% in the A1 horizon to 226% in the BW horizon. Obviously, that's on a weight basis, but it gives you an idea of just how much water these soils are capable of holding. And it's due to the high surface area of the allophane and the associated weathering products in there. And this particular soil, interestingly enough, they're growing cilantro and peppers on it. So idea of it, that's what I would think of as specialty crops. So think about that. At wilting point, 147% water content on a weight basis. If we look a little closer to home, here's one of our North Idaho landscapes. Pretty scenic, looks like a postcard. And I think that it's kind of peaceful looking, and it sort of belies the geologic history where, you know, after you guys turned in the assignment, you all had something about Missoula floods. And so this area was subject to the floodwaters. And so you had these big ice age floods, and then right after that, you get this huge volcanic eruption of Mount Mazama. So it's simply a matter of flooding and volcanoes blowing up. And but I guess given that, this really does look sort of peaceful in comparison. And most of the soils that you find up in northern Idaho and northeastern Washington do have a mantle of volcanic ash on them. And if you look, you take some of the surface horizon and look at it under magnification, probably look like this, you can see that, to me, this is a volcanic ash. This is a what we would call volcanic glass, and it's a very glassy material. It kind of looks like a sponge. It's got all these little holes in it, and this is what happens when you get a really viscous type of lava that gets blasted out. You know, it's got a lot of gas in it, and that's why you get the vesicles in those particles. And that's one of the reasons that they're light, because they have these vesicles or pores in them. And it's also one of the reasons that as these things start to weather, you've got a lot of surface area on there, and that's partly why they weather quickly, and the water holding capacity and some of those characteristics. here's a profile you've seen a few times, and this is a, one of the most extensive soil series that we have in northern Idaho. It's called the Bonner series, and you recognize this profile. So here's the ash mantle from the surface down to about 50 centimeters, and then this is sand and gravel, it looks like, below it. Probably some sort of outwash, maybe related to Glacial Lake Missoula. So this ash mantle, a BW horizon in there, and that's typically what we see in terms of development, not argillic horizons or anything like that. If you look at most of these ash mantles around here, they probably have maybe 5% clay size material in them, as best as it can be measured. So they don't have a lot of colloidal material in them, but what they do have is extremely active. The couple things you might notice here. Here's the classification of this soil. Ashy over sandy skeletal. And remember last time I think we talked about this business of something over something else, and that's where you have a lithologic discontinuity. So in this case, this is the ashy material, and this would be the sandy skeletal material. And then the mineralogy, they have glassy over isotic. So this is the glassy part, this is isotic. This term aniso is not common, but it's used to refer to a situation where you have very different characteristics there across that lithologic discontinuity. Frigid would be the temperature regime, and this guy is a typic vitri xerand. So xeric moisture regime, the vitri means glassy and typical variety, but it's kind of a mouthful. Ashy over sandy skeleton and iso glassy over isotic frigid typic vitreous area. This ash mantle we've talked about, it comes from the eruption of Mount Mazama 7,700 years ago. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. The one more example of an andesol area, and this is from Iceland. This is a pretty interesting area to look at because look at this landscape. Here's andesols here, and you can see in the foreground it looks kind of like a moonscape. And what's happened because of centuries of overgrazing, primarily by sheep, Iceland has more sheep than people, the vegetative cover got removed, and this is the interior part of Iceland. It's windy, it's cold, and by removing the vegetative cover, it really left the landscape susceptible to wind erosion. And so you find these areas where the volcanic ash has been blown away, and what it leaves behind is glacial till, which tends to be really coarse textured, and you can see there's not much growing there. And interestingly enough, in Iceland, they call these areas the desert. So you go to the desert, and this is a desert with 1,400 millimeters of annual precip. So a little bit different than my idea of what a desert is. But the reason it's a desert is because you don't have the finer textured andesol material there to support the plants. So it looks like this rocky moonscape instead. And a lot of you have heard the term desertification, where you create this irreversible change in vegetative cover as a result of disruption of the soil or the vegetation, and that's exactly what's happened here. They've more or less turned this into a desert because of the overgrazing. And here's the soil profile that goes with it where it hasn't been eroded. You can see that the soil profile, I think most of you would be hard pressed to pick out too many horizons in that thing. It's not very old in terms of the age. And to me, you know, maybe there's a little bit of darkening up there in the surface, but the rest of it looks pretty similar. And in fact, the way that they have the horizons drawn out, you can see A1, A2, BW1, BW2. So not a lot of action in terms of horizon formation. The classification up here, medial. So there again, that's the substitute for a particle size, meaning it's moderately weathered. Amorphic, which sounds like a mineralogical thing. Typic haplocryan, so it's in the cryan suborder. Mean annual soil temperature between 8 and 0 in cold summers. And the couple notes there, quite a bit of organic carbon in it, which is characteristic of andisols. They do tend to store higher amounts of organic carbon. Not much distinctive horizonation, which is pretty obvious. And here again, annual precip is about 1,400 millimeters on an annual basis. So any questions on those? Well, I've got some supplemental material here, and if you haven't figured it out, andisols are one of my favorite soils, and part of that is because we live in an area where we've got lots of andisols, and the source of the vast majority of volcanic ash that we have in the Northwest is this Crater Lake, which used to be Mount Mazama 7,700 years ago. How many of you have visited there? Just a handful? Well, if you haven't, I would really recommend, if you get the opportunity, do it, because it's worth seeing. And I know you've seen pictures of it, but to see it in real life is sort of what I would describe as a breathtaking experience. It's a huge caldera, or now it's a lake because it's filled up with water. It's actually some of the cleanest water you'll find anywhere in the world. And I think at one point they set a record here for the depth with which you could see down through water in a lake. I don't know if that's still true, but there's really no development on the water. They have a few boats that they allow in there, but that's pretty much it. So what happened 7,700 years ago, prior to the eruption, Mount Mazama was probably about a 12,000 foot peak, and it would have been very impressive. Now, I don't know if you've seen this before, but this guy, Paul Rockwell, or Rockwood, has this idea of what it looked like prior to the eruption. So you can see it's a big tall peak with snow on it, probably some glaciers, and it starts steaming like this. And the next thing you know, it blows up, and all of this volcanic material gets blown out really high up, what we call the Plinian type eruption, where it gets blasted up 30,000 feet and it gets into the jet stream and the wind, so all of it gets carried, in this case, mostly in an eastward or northeastern direction from Crater Lake. And I guess what I think about, you got this mountain here, and all the stuff that gets blown out is coming from well below the surface. So it gets blown out, and all of a sudden there's nothing left there to support that mountaintop. So this thing just kind of falls down, and that's what leaves that big caldera or crater. And this is the extent of it, and actually a very conservative map of the extent. This area that you see in brown is where you have recognizable deposits of Mazama ash on the surface, or at least where you did. This yellow thing in here is from Glacier Peak, a different eruption. But you can see this, here's Mount Mazama down here. So it's mostly north and east, the direction. And actually they found Mazama ash in as far east as back into plain states, and it's all over the place. But I'd say this map represents where there was probably a significant surficial deposit left behind. And if you look at the distribution of andisols today, here's a map, and it's kind of like what we've looked at. The areas that show up as dark are where you have mostly andisols, and as you get into the yellower colors, they're still present there, but they're not the dominant soils. And you can see the northern Idaho, big concentration here, and these are all mid to higher elevation soils. Western Montana, northeastern Washington, all across the Okanagan Highlands, and you get into the Cascade Range and the Coast Range. And then you've got the Blue Mountains and the Wallowa Mountains in Oregon. Yeah, Larry.
So that big part of eastern Washington there, why is that all blanked out? Or is that soils are washed away?
Some of it is, yeah, because the channel stab land would be down through here. Well, we talked a little bit about this on our field trip, and that is that one of the things that, if you think about this volcanic ash getting dumped more or less uniformly over this whole area, okay, what's going to keep it in place in the drier areas in the landscape? Well, there really was no mechanism because the vegetation was probably dead, and even if grass came back, grass dies back on an annual basis. And whereas in the forested areas, if the trees come back, you get the canopy cover, you get litter being deposited on an annual basis. And over time, what it does is it stabilizes the site. So a lot of what you see here in terms of the areas where andisols are present are areas that have forest vegetation on them. And I think it's really a physical protection type of a mechanism from the litter layer and the canopy covers. And also some of the forests, at least higher elevations, are less susceptible to fire and, you know, just any sort of disturbance. So yeah, all of this, you know, where did all this end up? Well, probably in the Columbia River, and a lot of it's out in the Pacific Ocean right now. So one of the things in the inland region, and really talking about these areas in here, you know, if you look at the most productive, forest that we find here, any forester worth their weight will tell you that these are the soils that have volcanic ash mantles, or in most cases, the andisols. And in fact, if you look at the effect of volcanic ash mantles and the thickness on, this is Douglas fir site index change. So what you're doing is looking at I think it's a 50-year site index. You look at the height of a tree. And what this means is that, here's an example. If you have a 20 centimeter thick ash mantle, you can expect that the Doug fir trees there are going to be 3.5 meters taller on average than those where you don't have an ash mantle. And really, this curve, you can see it's steep in here. And once you get up to about 30, 40, 50 centimeters of ash, it starts to level off a little bit. But it really is important down in that lower range, just because of the, in large part, the water holding capacity. Because if you start asking yourself, all right, what is it about the ash itself that makes these soils productive? Well, a lot of people think that this volcanic glass is kind of a magic fertilizer, but if you look at the elemental composition of this stuff, it shouldn't be too surprising. It's dominated by silicon, aluminum, sodium, iron, potassium. You get down here to these, what we would think of as plant nutrients, potassium, calcium, magnesium, pretty small amounts. So yeah, it's got some nutrient value, but in terms of it being a magical fertilizer or wonderful soil amendment, not really, at least in the chemical sense. So this kind of, and I mentioned this characteristic of phosphorus retention, and this is an example of what it looks like. Now, let me explain this. So the y-axis here is the amount of phosphorus that is added to a soil that gets absorbed or attached to the soil in an irreversible manner, meaning that plants can't get at it. The x-axis here is the amount of phosphorus that's in soil solution, or that's the phosphorus that plants can get. So what you do is you take, this is an andic soil, here's a non-andic soil, you add increasing amounts of phosphorus to it, you shake it up, and then you measure how much of the phosphorus is in solution. And you can see with the andic soils, with these incremental additions of phosphorus, what's happening to the amount that's in soil solution? It's not really going up that much. You can see even up here, you've got 1 part per million in soil solution. And I think, I don't remember what this addition represents, but it's adding a bunch of phosphorus to the soil. So what happens is most of it is getting attached to the ferrihydrite and the allophane, and it's attached in such a way that it's rendered unavailable to plants. Whereas these non-andic soils, you start adding more phosphorus and you see this huge increase in the amount of soluble phosphorus, or what's in soil solution. So this is what I guess the way that you would see this phosphorus retention. And I think a lot of you know that the university at one time had an experiment station up in Sandpoint, which is north of here, andisols. and they were going to use it for landscaping. And this was back in the 60s, I think, when the land was given to the university. And so they start trying to grow different types of landscaping plants, horticultural plants. They can't get anything to grow there very well. So they run every soil test in the book. And this is back before we really knew much about andisols and some of these characteristics. And they started looking at plant tissue, and they realized that, boy, these plants don't have much phosphorus in it. And that's when they kind of got clued into this idea of this phosphorus retention. And they did some studies up there that I think the net result was it took about 1,500 pounds of phosphorus per acre to satisfy this phosphorus retention capacity of the soils. And only after that could you start to add phosphorus and see a noticeable response by the plants growing there. So, given this, how do you explain productive forests on andisols? You'd think they would probably not have sufficient phosphorus, right? Well, I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if anybody does, but here's one of the possibilities: mycorrhizal fungi. Most of the plants that the trees that grow in this region do have mycorrhizal associations. So you look at the roots; they have these fungi growing on them that are apparently greatly enhance the ability to take up phosphorus as well as other nutrients. And as I said, I have no proof that this is the reason why the trees do so well in the face of having this phosphorus problem, but it seems likely. The other thing about these ash mantles, lots of water holding capacity. Here are two soil profiles from the region, and these bars represent, it says water retention difference. It's basically the amount of plant available water. And the orange represents the ash mantles, the white horizons are the whatever the underlying geology or parent material is. And you can see how much of the total water holding capacity is contained in these ash mantles. So what happens if you take the ash mantles off? Well, you're definitely going to lose a major portion of the water holding capacity. And what we've seen in this region, probably as a result of fire, primarily fire, whether it's man-caused or natural fire, but afterwards there are areas where this volcanic ash mantle has been lost, and you get these shrub fields that come back. And what we think is going on in these is that because the ash mantle is lost, that water holding capacity goes with it. And these are sites that can no longer support the forest community because there's not sufficient water holding capacity. You all know it gets dry around here in the summertime and water is limiting. So in a sense, what we've done is our own version of desertification, and it may be not our fault, but you think about the longer term prospects, the only way this is going to come back that I can think of is if there's another big volcanic eruption and maybe a few thousand years for that stuff to weather. So it's something that definitely should be considered. And I think these areas with ash mantles, if there are fires, that probably one of the priorities would be to get something growing on it as soon as possible and prevent the erosion of it. Okay, well that's about it for andisol. So everything up through andisols will be on the test on Thursday, and as I said, we'll spend some time in class at the beginning to go over questions you might have.